Hi, today is Friday, March 8th, 2024. My name's Harold Topper, and I'll be reading from today's edition of the Stanford Advocate. Headline article, quote, uncommitted, end quote, primary protest votes could happen in Connecticut. Byline, Jordan Nathaniel Fenster. Some Connecticut Democrats say they will vote, quote, uncommitted, end quote, as a protest vote against President Joe Biden's handling of the war in Israel and Gaza, a strategy experts say was used with some success in other states. On Super Tuesday, voters in seven states had the option of voting, quote, uncommitted, end quote. In Minnesota, quote, uncommitted, end quote, votes made up 19% of the total. Connecticut is one of more than 20 states with primaries after Super Tuesday in which voters can choose an uncommitted line on the ballot. Omar Scott Antar, a Connecticut Democrat member of a grassroots organization, Abandon Biden, said he and others in the state are hoping to replicate the success they saw in places like Minnesota, North Carolina, and Michigan. We were very encouraged by the 100,000-plus votes for uncommitted in the Michigan primary, he said. We decided deliberately to encourage people to vote uncommitted. Connecticut's primary election is scheduled for April 2nd. Votes for uncommitted are a, quote, message that shouldn't be ignored, end quote, said Nancy DiNardo, chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Connecticut. I would think it certainly would be sending a message that even in Connecticut, which tends to be blue, what is it that the National Democratic Party should do to get more people supporting the Democrats, she said. Vote counts on the uncommitted line in Connecticut presidential primaries have traditionally been low. In the 2020 Democratic primary, 5,975 votes were cast for uncommitted, according to state data. There were 12,994 Republican uncommitted votes that year, up from 2,728 the year before. Ben Proto, Connecticut Republican Party chairman, said it's possible Republican voters might use the uncommitted line as a protest vote against Donald Trump, but he believes Democrats are far likelier to rely on that strategy, which is being used this year as a protest against a specific policy. If someone doesn't want to vote for Donald Trump or doesn't want to vote for Nikki Haley, they could cast a vote for Ron DeSantis, he said. Bill Shortell, a New Britain Democratic Town Committee chairman, committee member, and a member of the Democratic State Central Committee, said, if Biden is the candidate after the Democratic convention, I'm going to support him. But in the meantime, I tend to vote uncommitted and to urge other people to do that in the hope that he'll drop out and we'll get another candidate that will have a better chance of winning. Scott McLean, political science professor at Quinnipiac University, said the use of uncommitted votes as a message requires organization. Uncommitted is not a very targeted message, he said. It requires that organization, that movement, to really have that vote, have that kind of meeting other than I can't make up my mind. You need an organization to encourage people to make that vote and to know what the meaning is behind that vote. Otherwise, it really does nothing, he said, though McLean believes it has been an effective strategy thus far. It did have an impact in Michigan, he said. I think it will continue to have an impact. I think it frightens the president's campaign advisors that this could snowball and become a much more widespread kind of thing. Antar said those organization efforts have not gone much further than resolutions to use the strategy in discussions online. There has not yet been any funding committed to the effort. It hasn't been formalized, he said. While Tom Swan, executive director of political advocacy organization Connecticut Citizen Action Group, said he has not yet seen any organized effort in the state to use the uncommitted ballot line to send a message to the president, but that it has been effective in other states. I think the message was they wanted a policy change, and I think they delivered it in a really strategic and effective way, he said. It's happening in a lot of states. I could see people using it here. In addition to DeSantis, Trump, and Haley, Ryan Binkley will also be a choice for Connecticut Republican primary voters. Democrats will be able to choose between Biden, Marianne Williamson, Dean Phillips, and Cenk Uygur. Both ballots will include an uncommitted choice. Though Antar said voters affiliated with Abandon Biden do not necessarily want Trump to be in office. Our message is abandon Biden and don't vote for Trump, he said. Moving now to the next article. 11 city reps call colleagues, quote, animal farm, end quote, comparison, quote, dehumanizing, end quote. Group wants him censured. Byline, Ignacio LaGuarda, Dateline Stanford. A member of the Stanford Board of Representatives wrote an op-ed in the Stanford Advocate last month comparing certain fellow members to characters from the classic novel Animal Farm. Now he's at risk of being censured. A special meeting was requested by 11 members of the board to consider censuring Representative Carl Weinberg, Democrat from District 20, and required he take sensitivity training. The meeting was originally scheduled for Thursday, but was postponed on Wednesday because Weinberg will be on vacation with his wife. By late Wednesday afternoon, it had yet to be rescheduled. Weinberg referenced George Orwell's 1945 novel when writing about the practice of, quote, double-dipping, end quote, within the Stanford Democratic City Committee. That occurs when sitting members of the Board of Representatives also occupy a seat on the DCC. Doing so allows members to endorse themselves for a position on the board, making it difficult for any outsiders to challenge them. Weinberg criticized a faction of the Democratic Party known as Reform Stanford for running multiple members of the Board of Representatives in Tuesday's DCC election, a strategy that was not successful as almost all of those candidates lost. Reform Stanford's double-dipping hypocrisy reminds me of the great George Orwell fable Animal Farm, Weinberg wrote. The pigs on the farm led a revolution and expelled their human overseers. By the end of the book, the ruling pigs have adopted all of the human behaviors that they had pledged to eliminate. He concluded his op-ed with, "It looks like Reform Stanford has decided to emulate the ruling pigs in Animal Farm." Some members of the board were offended by the use of the word pigs in the op-ed, even though Weinberg was describing the main characters of the well-known book. One of our colleagues used dehumanizing language, quote, ruling pigs, end quote, in reference to several members of the Board of Representatives in an op-ed that was published in the Stanford Advocate, wrote Representative Jeffrey Stella, Democrat from District 9, in a letter attached to the meeting agenda. These members include African Americans, immigrants, children of immigrants, Latinos, people who speak English as a second language, women, etc. Regardless of whether the members fall into protected classes or not, calling a colleague a, quote, ruling pig, end quote, is always wrong, although the sting may be felt in a sharper way for some. In a phone interview Wednesday, Stella said Weinberg could have used a different comparison when making his point. He knew what he was doing, said Stella, who requested the censure meeting. Representatives Terry Adams, Sean Baker, Bonnie Kim Campbell, Jennifer Matheny, Fred Pierre Lewis, Robert Rocheda, Ines Safik, Annie Somerville, Kendria Walston, and Dakari Watkins signed on to the request. The agenda also comes with a resolution to censure Weinberg that accuses the representative of openly attacking other board members during meetings. If the board votes to censure Weinberg, he would be asked to complete sensitivity training. On Wednesday, Weinberg pushed back on the allegations. "I don't think I've done any of the things I'm being accused of doing," he said in a telephone interview. Moving now to the next front page article. Quote, "It is a major blow to our cartoonist community," end quote. Wilton resident Chance Brown dies at age 75. Byline Bob Reiser, Dateline Wilton. Chance Brown had no illusions during the decades he illustrated the comic strip characters in, quote, High and Lois, end quote, and edited gags for, quote, Hager the Horrible, end quote, that he was creating in the shadows of his father, Dick Brown, and fellow Connecticut cartoonist icon, Mort Walker. Chance knew that if he wasn't drawing those round noses every day, he wouldn't be doing his painting or recording his music, said his wife, Deborah Brown. Those two comic strips provided for more than just our own family, but for Mort Walker's too, and it continued their father's legacy. As a result of the comic strip's success, Chance Brown avoided the alleys of the starving artist and pursued his side passions for watercolors and blues guitar, living the life of a loving suburban father that the quote, High and Lois, end quote, strip has represented for the last 70 years. It was a rich quality of life, Deborah Brown told Hearst, Connecticut media on Thursday, 3 days after her husband died. Music was really his passion, and he was an exceptional guitar player. Chance Brown died Monday at his home at age 75 after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Brown's death was met with shock and sadness. "It is a major blow to our cartoonist community to lose Chance," said C.J. Kettler, president of King Feature Syndicate, which is a unit of Hearst. The Brown family is one of the founding Connecticut cartoonist families. Fellow Connecticut cartoonist Brian Walker of Norwalk agreed, "We grew up together and became very close in the last 20 years. He was like a brother to me, and I have my own brothers," said Walker, whose father, Mort Walker, created the humor strip, quote, Beetle Bailey, end quote, and co-created, quote, High and Lois, end quote, with Dick Brown. "I'm really going to miss him. It's a huge void in my life." Both he and his dad had an ability to be profound and funny at the same time, and we would talk frequently about our shared legacy of living in the shadows of our fathers, who are legendary cartoonists, Brian Walker said. "I don't think we ever deceived ourselves to think that we would reach the level and talent and expertise of our fathers. We just tried to keep working at getting better at what we do." Chance Brown's death comes 1 year after the death of his brother Chris Brown, who illustrated Hagar the Horrible, and 6 years after the death of Mort Walker, whose 2018 celebration of life drew Doonesbury strip creator Gary Trudeau and other scores of cartoonists from around the country to Greenwich. A celebration of Chance Brown's life is being planned for the summer, with details to be released by the family when they are finalized. On Thursday, the family's focus was on sharing their grief. "We have three daughters, and we have all been together since before Chance's passing," Deborah Brown said, "and that has been a great comfort to be a unit and share the sadness together." In his final days, Chance Brown sat at the kitchen table and sketched the living room of their Wilton home. On Valentine's Day, he painted a watercolor heart for his wife. "It was very hard for him," she said. "I am going to keep that heart forever." In the end, quote, "all four of us were holding him and speaking to him," end quote, Deborah Brown said. "The last day he was peaceful, and that made his transition much easier. My son-in-law was playing acoustic guitar," she said. "It was very peaceful and beautiful send-off." What does Chance Brown's death mean for the future of some of the comic page's most enduring strips? The short answer is the strips will stay in the Brown and Walker family businesses, both families said. "Our girls are all writers," said Deborah Brown, who is an editor for the Hagar the Horrible strip. "We plan to bring them into the family business as writers and illustrators and multimedia producers. We plan to continue with the family business." Moving now to the next front page article. Lamont, labor deal extends pay raises. Byline John Moritz, Dateline Hartford. Governor Ned Lamont announced a tentative agreement with a coalition of state employee labor unions on Wednesday to preserve an annual 2.5% wage increase over the next fiscal year. The agreement applies to the final year of a four-year $1.9 billion contract with the State Employees Bargaining Agent Coalition that was ratified by lawmakers in 2022. That contract included wage and step increases in each of the first 3 years, along with a clause allowing the state and the unions to renegotiate those hikes for the final fiscal year ending on June 30th, 2025. Those rates will stay the same under the reopener agreement. In a statement Wednesday, Lamont praised the work of the roughly 45,000 state employees that fall under the CBAC coalition. Those include healthcare and social service workers, police officers, university professors, prosecutors, judicial staff, and corrections officers. This agreement continues the current wage pattern, reflecting our need to ensure the retention of our best employees while recognizing the need to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars, Lamont said. "I want to thank our union partners and our negotiating staff for their efforts with this agreement." Members of each of the 15 individual labor unions within CBAC will now get a chance to vote on the agreement. If approved by the unions, the agreement will go to the state's General Assembly for ratification. "We continue to face a service crisis due to the recruitment and retention lapses at many of our work sites," CBAC said in a statement on its website. "We have full contract negotiations beginning in 2025, and pension and health care negotiations coming up soon with the expiration of the current master CBAC agreement in 2027. With that in mind, it made sense to resolve this year's reopener as quickly as possible in time for legislative approval prior to the July 1st, 2024 effective date. The cost of the latest agreement has yet to be determined by the state's fiscal analysts, according to Chris Cullaby, a spokesman for the Office of Policy and Management. A report tied to the original contract estimated the cost of wage, a 2.5% increase in fiscal 2025, to be roughly $96.5 million, not including the costs of the step increases. Republicans have criticized Lamont's agreements with labor unions as overly generous at a time when the state's budget is pushing up against mandatory spending caps, thus limiting lawmakers' ability to spend money elsewhere. House Minority Leader Vincent Candelora, Republican from North Brantford, said Wednesday that Republicans will heavily scrutinize the reopening agreement and push for changes to remote work policies for state employees. It's frustrating that the governor continues to give out salary increases, bonuses, and praise for our workers without having a conversation about the impact of telework, Candelora said, adding that he's fielded calls from constituents complaining that they can't get state employees to answer the phone at their offices. On Tuesday, Lamont also submitted to lawmakers an agreement to boost pay for home health workers who compensated through the state but not considered state employees, from $18.25 an hour to $23 an hour by 2026, while also providing them with two extra paid holidays, paid time off, and longevity bonuses. Moving now to the final front page article, Stanford YMCA to close for good due to declining enrollment. Byline Ignacio LaGuardia, Dateline Stanford. A Stanford institution that has called the city home since 1868 will close by the end of the month. The Stanford YMCA, which has been at its Bell Street location for almost 50 years and previously was on Atlantic Street, will shutter because of declining enrollment. A notice was posted on the center's website announcing the closure. "We have been a proud member of the Stanford community for over 150 years, wrote Peter Weiland, YMCA board treasurer, in the note. "Unfortunately, as a result of declining revenues and escalating expenses, it was a clear decision that the operations were financially unsustainable." However, the Stanford Y is still likely to exist in some format going forward, said Board Chairman Paul McCary. "We want to be able to reconfigure the value of our services without walls," he said. Although he was unable to provide specific details on what that could look like, McCary said Y leadership is in communication with other community organizations like the Urwitz Center, the Mill River Park Collaborative, and the Boys and Girls Club of Stanford to discuss possible partnerships. "We still want to be able to provide and deliver services to the Stanford community as best as we can in perhaps a different model," he said. The note posted on the organization's website cites declining enrollment, the after effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the reduction of public funds for after-school care as the reasons for the center closing. "I don't think there was one silver bullet here," McCary said. "There was a number of different things that took place. The COVID-19 pandemic was particularly devastating to the fitness facility," McCary said. According to him, the center's membership dropped by 30 to 40% after the facility reopened once COVID-19 restrictions were lifted. "During the height of the pandemic, the YMCA was closed, as were other fitness centers, because of state restrictions meant to curb the spread of the virus. Coming out of the pandemic was very challenging for us," McCary said. Along with market pressures, the maintenance and repair of the 50-year-old building where the Y is located added to the nonprofit's growing expenses, he said. McCary said a new basketball court floor and a new air conditioning system for the gym were two large expenses in recent years. Chronic water damage from a leaky roof and other HVAC issues only added to the bottom line. The Stanford YMCA boasts a 6-lane indoor swimming pool, a basketball court with an elevated track, and workout facilities among its offerings. The daycare program at the center has already been shut down, as has been the pool. According to McCary, there are between 4 and 6 full-time staff workers at the YMCA and another 20 part-time employees, including swimming and Zumba class instructors. He said efforts are underway to help those workers transition to jobs either at other YMCA locations or similar organizations nearby. A letter recently sent to members includes a list of the 5 YMCA centers, Darien, Greenwich, Wilton, New Canaan, and Westport, that would honor the Stanford membership rate for 3 months. We've been working hard behind the scenes to ensure you can easily continue your fitness journey, the letter reads. Financial aid will be available to members after the initial 3-month period, according to the letter. We wanted to make sure we did our best to give the staff and membership the softest landing as possible, McCary said. Information on the current membership numbers were not immediately available. It's unclear what will become of the building at 10 Bell Street. McCary said selling it is one option, but board members are still gathering information on what they could do with it. The current building used to be part of a larger facility that included a 132-room hotel, also run by the YMCA. A 1975 article in the Stanford Advocate announced that the hotel, traditionally only available to men, was accepting women. The hotel portion of the building was sold to a developer in 2008 and later became the Hotel Zero Degrees. Currently, it is the home of the Lloyd Hotel. At the time of the sale, the Stanford YMCA was similarly going through financial distress, with a declining membership leading to a $200,000 annual deficit, according to a 2008 Stanford Advocate article. Reflecting on the decision to close the Stanford YMCA for good, McCary said it was difficult but also expected. We knew it was coming, he said. We pushed it off as long as we could. However, he said he remains optimistic that the Y will still have a future in the city. I'm very sad we had to make this decision, but looking at our strategic alternatives going forward and the collaborations we're talking about and the plans we're developing, we're very excited, he said. Today's death notices. From Norwalk, Therese Martin Egan. Moving now to Hunger for Sunlight. Why are clocks set forward in the spring? Byline Jamie Stengel, Dateline Dallas. Once again, most Americans will set their clocks forward by 1 hour this weekend, losing perhaps a bit of sleep, but gaining more glorious sunlight in the evenings as the days warm into summer. Where did this all come from, though? How we came to move the clock forward in the spring and then push it back in the fall is a tale that spans over more than a century, one that's driven by 2 world wars, mass confusion at times, and a human desire to bask in the sun for as long as possible. There's been plenty of debate over the practice, but about 70 countries, about 40% of those across the globe, currently use what Americans call daylight saving time. While springing the clocks forward, quote, kind of jolts our system, end quote, the extra daylight gets people outdoors, exercising and having fun, says Anne Buckle, web editor at timeanddate.com, which features information on time, time zones, and astronomy. The really, really awesome advantage is the bright evenings, right? She says. It is actually having hours of daylight after you come home from work to spend time with your family or activities, and that is wonderful. Here are some things to know so you'll be conversant about the practice of humans changing time. How did this all get started? In the 1890s, George Vernon Hudson, an astronomer and entomologist in New Zealand, proposed a time shift in the spring and fall to increase the daylight. And in the early 1900s, British home builder William Willett, troubled that people weren't up enjoying the morning sunlight, made a similar push. But neither proposal gained enough traction to be implemented. Germany began using daylight saving time during World War I with the thought that it would save energy. Other countries, including the United States, soon followed suit. During World War II, the U.S. once again instituted what was dubbed, quote, wartime, end quote, nationwide, this time year-round. In the United States today, Every state except Hawaii and Arizona observes daylight saving time. Around the world, Europe, much of Canada, and part of Australia also implement it, while Russia and Asia don't currently. Inconsistency and mass confusion. After World War II, a patchwork of timekeeping emerged across the United States, with some areas keeping daylight saving time and others ditching it. You might have one town has daylight saving time, the neighboring town might have daylight saving time, but start it and end it on different dates, and the third neighboring town might not have it at all, said David Prurau, author of the book, quote, Seize the Daylight, the Curious and Contentious Story of Daylight Saving Time, end quote. At one point, if riders on a 35-mile, 56-kilometer bus ride from Steubenville, Ohio to Moundsville, West Virginia, wanted their watches to be accurate, they'd need to change them 7 times as they dipped in and out of daylight saving time, Prurau says. So in 1966, the U.S. Congress passed the Uniform Time Act, which says states can either implement daylight saving time or not, but it has to be statewide. The act also mandates the day that daylight saving time starts and ends across the country. Confusion over the time change isn't just something from the past. In the nation of Lebanon, last spring, chaos ensued when the government announced a last-minute decision to delay the start of daylight saving time by a month, until the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Some institutions made the change, and others refused as citizens tried to piece together their schedules. Within days, the decision was reversed. It really turned into a huge mess where nobody knew what time it was, Buckle says. Moving now to our final article. Paul Simon to receive PEN, America's Literary Service Award. Dateline, New York. Paul Simon's latest honor places him among public figures well outside the music industry. He is this year's winner of PEN America's Penn Audible Literary Service Award, which previously has been given to former President Barack Obama, the late Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, and Stephen King, among others. The 82-year-old Simon is known for such classic songs as, quote, Bridge Over Troubled Water, end quote, and, quote, The Sound of Silence, end quote, and for his globe-spanning musical taste from Brazil to South Africa to his native New York City. Later this month, he will be featured in the MGM Plus docuseries, quote, In Restless Dreams, The Music of Paul Simon, end quote. Paul Simon has inspired fans worldwide with lyrics and songs that entire generations know by heart and can recognize from their very first notes, PEN America's CEO Suzanne Nossel said in a statement Thursday. His fascination with different cultures, traditions, and rhythms have helped open our ears and minds to essential music traditions. We are elated to pay tribute to this unparalleled creative artist whose music, along with his commitment to humane values and humanitarian causes, has made him a cultural icon. Simon will receive his award at Penn's annual gala to be held May 16th at the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan. Last year, Penn presented the literary prize to a longtime friend of Simon's, quote, Saturday Night Live, end quote, creator, Lorne Michaels. On Thursday, Penn also announced it was presenting its Business Visionary Award to Almar Latour, CEO of Dow Jones and publisher of The Wall Street Journal. Penn, a prominent advocate for free expression, cited his efforts to bring about the release of journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who has been held in Russia for nearly a year on allegations of espionage. Well, that's all the time we have today. It's Friday, March 8th, 2024. My name is Harold Topper, and I've been reading from today's edition of the Stanford Advocate. Please stay safe.